Interview with Nadi-san, P. No date.
From the way you spoke last time, I presume that you did history.
Yes.
And let me ask just from sociological viewpoint, lots of schools and what area? Just now, from?
Club or college.
So, presumably you had a Western and urban background.
Yes.
I was wondering whether that presented problems when you were out in the field.
You know, actually the problems in the field were mainly connected with land work. And latterly during the war, at least in the early part of the war, it was connected with food production. I dare say the type of education we received really didn't fit us for that type of calling. But nonetheless, we did it, although I particularly did not like land work. But I did not consider it interesting at that time at all. But we had to do it, and I think we did a fairly good job.
How about the question of rapport with the peasantry whom you were dealing?
There wasn't much of it at that time. In fact, I think that the present-day civil servants are far better equipped that way, considering the environment from which they have come, the schooling they have received, and so on and so forth, to undertake closer liaison with the peasantry.
Of course, there are pros and cons for this. The fact that you were not that closely identified with the people presumably helps you to be more impartial and to adopt the role of guardian.
Well, there is certainly that to be said for it, but I'm wondering whether that outweighs some of the other advantages or disadvantages, you might like to call it, of our social and educational upbringing. Because the peasant really wanted somebody, or wanted spoon feeding, I would say. They still do. In fact, when we were doing land work, one of the problems was to make a chap who was allotted land, they were giving him about 2-3 acres of high land, build his house and plant his small acreage. A tremendous amount of spoon feeding was required. We had to battle with a lot of laborers. And latterly, in some of the irrigation schemes, you know, where like Wallaway, where they were given 5 acres of paddy and 3 acres of highland. In fact, quite early on, let's say 20 years ago, the mudralali system had come into being. That is to say, essentially landlordism. The people at the Ambalangota Bazaar were the real landlords. They had their nominees on the allotment, cultivating the paddy and neglecting the highland.
This is on LDO land?
No, this is the colonization land I'm talking about now. LDO land had the same problem of people not helping themselves.
But wasn't the colonization land also given on the LDO tenure?
It was given on the LDO tenure, but the only thing is the government, I think, paid far more attention to colonization than to LDO land. And they were trying to make a success of this food production part of it, you know, the raising of paddy.
Under the LDO tenure, would these absentee landlords really have lost their...
They would have, except for political interference, which was not so marked in my time. But certainly, some of the more forceful politicians did make very strenuous attempts to keep bad hats on the allotment.
Even in the
1940s?
Then, in a sense, they were undermining the very basis of this ordinance, which was signed by Sedana.
That they have always done, you know. I mean, I don't think the politician who interfered in the work of the civil servant or administrator was unaware of the evil he was doing from the administrative point of view. But votes being worthwhile to him, he just didn't mind about that at all. In fact, I would go so far as to say that in my experience, one of the very few politicians, probably I just think of two or three perhaps, who never interfered with an administrative decision, were Maninayaka, I must say, the President Minister of Finance, J.J. Warner and Sir John. Those are the only three I know. In fact, they would ask you what it's all about. If they were satisfied that you had done your job, then there was nothing that need be done to alter it. They stood by you.
And I presume, what would CP be, having been a past administrator?
You see, CP and I were colleagues in the service. We never had occasion to work in the same department. And all I know is that he got involved in land development and food production in a big sort of way under Dudley when he was Minister of Agriculture. He later, I think, fell foul of the ministry or the minister and the government and retired. So I couldn't assess his work. But certainly he did seem to be quite an exceptional type of man at that time, considering that he also came from, I think, the Thomases.
Exceptional
in the sense that he's able to liaise with the peasantry. You see, and he certainly had a lot of enthusiasm for his work.
Would you say that at that time, the attitude of the civil servant was one of paternalism and a sort of impartial guardianship?
I would say that that is more or less what it was.
Without necessarily being snobbish, was there an...
Oh, there was that the modern snobbery, no doubt, there's no question about that.
An elitist concept?
Yes. That was a social concept which was dying hard. You couldn't avoid it.
Has it prevailed even today? Does it prevail?
I wouldn't say so, though certainly some members of the bureaucracy are making it very difficult for people to see them. And I don't think they're helping the government. That may be a result of overwork. If there are insufficient people in a department, well, you can't see everybody.
Were AGAs and GAs very much a law unto themselves in the court? And could they go against either the secretariat or local MPs and public opinion?
They could certainly stand up to local MPs. To public opinion, I don't think there was any particular thing that I could say, because they were fairly just in their attitudes and decisions. What is the other thing you
asked?
The secretariat, no, I would say no. Not, certainly not up to the time of the Solbury Constitution.
Knowing what they say.
That they wouldn't stand up to the secretariat unless there was some flagrant case. I have no actual knowledge of it, but I would say a man like Davidson, mm-hmm. He was the additional land commissioner, a very meticulous civil servant, perhaps the Velupilla Kumarasamy, also very difficult sort of fellow personally, but a good administrator. They certainly stood up, I think, to the secretariat at that time. But otherwise, I don't think there was very much of fighting.
Didn't Davidson tend to squabble with other officers?
Not as far as I know. My contact with him was purely as the head of one of the sections of the Land Commission. And I was very amazed at the way he did his work. For instance, I don't think there were stenographers there, certainly not many. He wrote his own letter, and they were lengthy ones. And in our time, we used to be fairly well guided by our land clerk. For instance, you write to the land commissioner about a certain lot in a certain plan, and without checking the plan. And that would come the reply from Davidson, a long story. And he would start off by saying, I feel obliged to point out that it is not lot number 16 PPA 31, but lot number 28B in some other plan. And you will never again send a letter to the land commissioner without checking your plan. You know, he was absolutely meticulous in his. He never took anybody or anything for granted. Checked it all his own. He was a very good land commissioner.
With regard to this, the growth of the political process and greater consciousness on the part of the peasantry and on other changes, you would say that there has been a closer identification between the administrators and the people?
No. Mm. Oh, yes.
But hasn't it affected impartiality?
Yes, the whole process of administration has been undermined from the point of view of discipline. Because, as I said the other day, you see, one of the basic flaws in our setup was the Donomo Constitution,
yes.
Which gave the politician a hand in the administration. And he felt, being a member of an executive committee, unless he meddled with some kind of appointment or promotion or something of that type, he was not really making himself felt. And so the legacy of the Donomo Constitution came to us so many times. And the example was there to be followed.
What about D.S. himself? Didn't he begin this process of interference?
In a way, D.S. was pretty sharp and cute about the type of interference he embarked on. But he did his share of interference. But the thing is, he had a finesse which modern politicians don't have. I would say, by and large, the old UNP politician, I'm now talking about, say, even pre-47, although there was no UNP, I'm talking about time. And even after 47 into the, say, early 50s, they had a finesse about the manner of their interference. But their successors certainly didn't have that.
It was a subtle form.
Very subtle.
I was wondering whether at the top level, for instance, D.S. wanted to have amenable permanent secretary, General D.S.
I have no doubt that he selected his first batch of permanent secretaries on that basis.
But weren't permanent secretaries supposed to be chosen independently of the government?
Yes, but at that time the Public Service Commission had not been set up. Of course, not that the PSC had anything to do with permanent secretaries even afterwards. And it had to be on the recommendation of the Prime Minister to the Governor General. So that element of choice remained with the Prime Minister.
So it was a direct... But hasn't this contributed to some unfairness and some wrangling and personal intriguing within the service?
Well, up to quite recently, it used to go on the basis of seniority. Until I think in the latter part of Mrs. Bandaranaike's time, there were a couple of appointments made. I wouldn't quarrel with the appointments as such, which did away with the seniority principle. And I do know of one appointment which was not made because the man was a Catholic. And there was all this anti-Catholic feeling being whipped out.
Is it out of place to ask the name of the person who suffered?
Well, he's now a permanent secretary, so really it was later rectified.
What about the Public Service Commission itself? Has it functioned as an independent body?
I think it just tried to function as such. I'm talking of the Public Service Commission I knew. That's up to the time of Sir Eric Gans. But there again, there was a lot of ministerial pull, certainly by the more powerful personalities among the cabinet, to have their own men or their own way in some manner. Since then, I suppose there has been a lot of talking, there's no question.
Talking about D.S., did he tend to go above the heads of AGAs and reprimand them or contravene their orders without giving them a chance for explanation?
I don't think that ever arose. D.S. never did that kind of thing. He had an idea of discipline and all that kind of thing, and if he wanted to disagree with you or of that type, he did it with your knowledge. If an order came, if some order of the AGA came up to him for something or other, he probably varied it. But he never reprimanded a man to my knowledge and made him feel small.
Didn't he collect around him a sort of trusted body of villainous advisors?
Yes, Arthur Ranasinghe was one. Of course, latterly Arthur Kurala, but he was his secretary and the personal relationship may have grown. Who were the others? Edmund Rodrigo was one of his hand-picked men in the early days, although he later fell foul of him, I think. Yes. Vaidyanathan, earlier on.
Earlier, and then
yes.
Jans?
Jans was not a confidant in that way.
Alivihara?
Yes, Alivihara, yes.
And, how about Sir John in his relationship to the permanent secretary?
Well, the only permanent secretary relationship with Sir John that I am aware of was when Arumugam was the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Communications and Works. I think he was about his only permanent secretary. There were acting appointments when Arumugam was on leave. But although Arumugam was a slow sort of a man, and Sir John was quite the opposite. He made a lot of use of his assistant secretaries. I don't think he gave Arumugam any trouble as such. There was no unpleasantness. Yes.
No, as Prime Minister, I wonder whether he influenced the choice of Permanent Secretary in
a... I don't think he ever promoted anybody except on the basis of seniority. I don't think certainly he is very happy about some of the appointments. But he didn't try to take the man who was next in seniority and put him over the senior.
And then how about 56 with regard to political interference in the whole of the public service? Did it increase after?
Yes, because what happened was a new set of men came into power who had not been in politics for the most part before. And their mental makeup seemed to be that they had to get a move on. There was certainly a great amount of keenness and enthusiasm. And they were trying to change as much of the old guard, I would say, the old system, the old men as possible. They pitchforked various confidants, the blue-eyed boys into various positions, key positions.
It contributed to stooging.
A lot of stooging arose as a result of the fear which even heads of departments had for people like peons because of tail carrying. You know, this is one of the most insidious features of undermining the public service.
And didn't some permanent secretaries first find out what the minister's views were and then submit them?
Well, that was part of the process of thinking that emerged in 56 or slightly earlier. I think permanent secretaries had then come to believe that the only comfortable existence they could eke out was by siding with the minister rather than fighting him, you see, or trying to change his views.
Even before him. But weren't there some independent types who ran foul of their ministers because?
Well, I don't know. I can't think of an example, but I certainly would say that Jayaratna is an independent type of man. Surely Amar Singh is.
For instance, Gunaratna and Mrs. Vimala Vijayavardhana didn't get on.
Perhaps, but what the reason was, I think? Well, it may be that Mrs. Vijayavardhana wanted to interfere with the administration more than she should have. That's very likely.
But now, one problem I presume many permanent secretaries face was the fact that their intellectual caliber was much higher than that of the minister.
That is inevitable even in England. We have that in England or anywhere in the world. You see, that is why I think it's laid down somewhere that the permanent secretary of the civil servant's duty is to advise his minister. If the minister disagrees, he must try to persuade him. But if he fails to persuade, he must carry it out, otherwise get out.
Yes, but the possibility is that this gap was so big at times that the minister might have had an inferior.
Very likely, but there are ministers, and there are ministers still, who make use of their permanent secretaries, consultants, and so on and so forth. But of course, lots of political decisions are taken without considering the administrative details.
Now, for instance, the switch over. How did that work? I know you were not there.
Which over? The language? You see, there, Bandaranaike had committed himself mentally to the possibility of single line 24 hours, which is a first-class political slogan. Because it took him much longer than that. But it had to be done. See, and when you have a break with the past like that, there are many imperfections which you've got to surmount. I suppose you had to please the public. The public is pleased. In fact, I don't know.
No, agreed. But weren't these imperfections more pronounced and necessary by bad planning in implementation?
But how well could you plan for a thing like that? It's something like this division of India and Pakistan. You know, at that time, administration had to break down for a couple of years.
If I could stray into the political field and then come back into your training and the posts you held, I'm not quite certain how long you have been with the Times.
3 years.
And in between?
In between I was managing director of the finance company called Investments and Securities.
Have you any sort of personal or second-hand knowledge about the factors which led to the Bandaranaike Chelvanayi campaign?
No. I think that purely the dictates of political convenience And equally, I suppose, political convenience and adventure or misadventure aborted it. Mm-hmm. I don't think Madanaka wanted to go back on it, except that there was this bhikkhu demonstration in the garden, and he had the spirit to stand up to it.
And take 58, for instance, I mean, he prevaricated about the
emergency. Yes.
Is it true that Gundevia's visit brought a gentle hint and that led him to take eventual related action?
Well, that together with the fact that I think a committee, a rather high-powered committee of Ceylon time, definite admirals, went and saw him. I think it was led by my uncle, Sarnasla Mahadeva, who was an old colleague of Bandanagar's. And they really... Pardon?
Was Vee Kumar
Swami? I don't know whether he was there, but I do know Sarnasla was there. I went to saw him and apprised him of the very grave consequences that would arise if he didn't take action. And that motivated him into rather late action. Fortunately, Sir Oliver was there.
Presumably this deputation was not a threat, but a means of persuasion.
Merely persuasion.
I'm coming to more recent times. For instance, in 60, have you any idea why the Federal Party chose not to support UN?
I don't want to libel anybody, but I think that the reason was that not Chelvanayagam so much, but some of the more ardent spirits in the Federal Party who had just got into politics were prepared to take the SLFP's overtures seriously. And that notwithstanding the fact that I did meet one of these very high ups, and I told him that this was the most wonderful chance that the entire Tamil community had for the whole century, that approximately 15 Tamil members would be able to thwart the course of history, change the whole run of the Sinhala-only Act by supporting the UNP government, because they would have to be on their best behavior and dependent on their votes for 5 years to rule. And they had the threat that any time they were dissatisfied with the administrative machinery employed for the Tamil-speaking people, they could throw the government out.
But retrospectively, aren't they in a better position in 65 and 60, because now, unlike in 60, the UNP are more committed to them?
I don't think so, because they can do without them. Vote-wise, if the Federal Party leaves, the UNP can still be in power. But in 60, certainly they could have. Yeah, as the defeat in the House on the throne speech could show.
In fact, I was just a student at that time, and though both the Sinhalese and the SLFP and the UNP had an anti-Sinhalese line, it was patent to me that the UNP were more likely to be cooperative than the SLFP by virtue of their composition.
I don't think that the UNP is any more pro-Tamil than the SLFP. Both are, I would say, very strong singular parties. There is no question about that, in spite of all the proffers of good intent. And they have only remained good intentions even today. What have the Tamil people got? Nothing. Except good words.
No, but don't think that they are more upper bourgeoisie composition. Tend to...
At heart, there is a lot of anti-Tamil feeling in the highest of it, at least among the people who matter.
Don't you think that this Sinhalese-Tamil conflict, I mean, deep cleavage, has affected the Tamil in such a way, and driven them into being a very defensive party, and therefore in their economic thinking, they have never been very radical.
When you say the defensive party?
Defensive in response to, shall I say, Sinhalese-nationalist aggression.
You mean they are thinking of just existing?
Yes.
Well, certainly the fact that the Federal Party has now given up with all its war slogans and all that feeling that they have whipped up over about 10 years in the campaign is indicative of a change of heart or a change of front. But what they are going to do in the next or in the next few years, I don't know, because supposing this district council bill never comes up, or it is thrown away, then the federal party has no option but to leave the government. And what are they going to tell the people? Except that they trusted the government, they wanted to work with them to see whether an amicable settlement of the problem was possible, and that now they are convinced that there is no way of solving the problem by friendly means.
Can you recall the Satyagraha campaign
on Bogatri? Yes, yes.
Who were the elements who organized the Satyagraha?
The more extreme backbench government people. The same type of people who I think who were instrumental, some of the people who were instrumental in the stopping the Kalaniya March, the Candy March, you know, of UNP, and all that stone throwing. And
what about Rajaratna?
I don't think Rajaratna is a thug at heart. You know, he is very fervent in his anti-Tamil outlook. But he speaks a lot about it. But I don't think basically he's a man who makes use of hard work.
And what about Satyagraha 1961, the one in, especially in the north? Tactically, do you think that it was a mistake?
No, I think it was it certainly worked. Only thing is that they called it off, I think, under the emergency in the army, isn't it? The army was sent there.
So, yes, it was separate.
But certainly the way it was going, it caused a lot of panic here. No question for government.
It worked. What do you mean by worked?
You mean the Satyagraha movement? Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that the government was in a panic, I would say, not worried. And you remember there was this, I'm thinking of 58 now, I'm thinking of the shipboard that went. But this particular Satyagraha movement that you're talking about, the sea campaign, you know, the car yeah. business, was a fine campaign. It was one of the things, I think, which really helped the Tamils to get back some of their self-respect.
It brought administration to a stand.
Oh, it did.
In particular, too, or only in Jaffna?
No, Jaffna, of course, it is very, very strong.
Particular?
I wouldn't say it was strong to the same extent, because the organization is all centered in Jaffna.
Why wouldn't
it? I have no personal knowledge.
And then, coming to your period as in the time, how would you describe and assess the period of coalition government, NM and
NDP? Assess it in what way?
I mean, what direction were they going, what mistakes did they make from their own point of view?
The direction, I think, was originally intended to bolster Mrs. Bandaranaike's government, because she was rather worried about being defeated in parliament. There was that worry. I don't know the precise details, but there was certainly some reason for it. And she thought that getting some of these intellectuals into the cabinet would probably help to stave off the economic crisis. But the way the coalition was going is that the Reds took command of the ship, so that their entire goal seemed to be what is very early and drastic socialization, tax-wise, and by making people who had any means at all get quite poor in a visibly short time.
Mm-hmm. But it is bad, this socialization, for the country.
No, it depends on this. Socialization is good in a country which has no other remedy. I mean, for instance, if every so-called poor man or petty boutique keeper plus landowner plus wage earner has a chance of becoming a small capitalist, would he not prefer that?
Don't you think that they adopted very bad tactics and a misplaced sense of priorities in bringing forward the press bill?
I think it was a very foolhardy move. I thought of it, there was no point. They thought that the press was inimical, and that if the press remained free to voice its opinion, they couldn't take the last step, which obviously they had in mind, to set up some form of dictatorship. There's no question about it. Otherwise, the there was no urgent hurry. If you had gone on with it, there were so many other things to be done in the country.
There is a story that, in fact, before the coalition was formed, Philip, through Nanasiya, had suggested to Mrs. B that a five-man junta be formed. And that this didn't come through because one of the proposed members, Ilendra, was against it.
I heard that story from quite an independent source who was close to the last government. And unbelievably, they say that Ilendra was against it.
You don't...
In the context of the man who told me, I mean, in view of his credentials, I believe. But if, normally, the man who would be most keen on any kind of an alliance with the rest in the SLFP would be Lagra. Because he's thinking in that way. He generally feels that that is the correct step to take.
But not with Philip, perhaps?
No, he was... let me see what the story was. Mrs. Bandaranaike found herself in this position of possible facing a possible defeat in Parliament.
Yes.
And she, I think it was, whatever it was, she had made some arrangements, or had in mind, some kind of a five-man junta. And Ilangaratna was sent for and asked what he thought of it. And his reaction apparently was, and not only asked what he thought of it, but that whether he would be one of them. He supposed to have said, Madam, personally, I don't like the idea. As a married man, I have children. And no junta lasts long. Because the same bayonets that you use to repress others can be used against you. And he then said, if you are in this fix, why not ask the leftists in? It was his suggestion, the producer version.
Who was supposed to be the other members?
Mrs. Bandaranaike, Philip, Felix, Nangaratna,
N.Q.?
No, I don't think N.Q. was there. N.Q. was going to be one of the
eight.
I forget the fifth name. Were there any names suggested to you?
It was N.Q. that was suggested.
No, it was not N.Q. There was definitely a politician in that.
S.L.F.P., Maitrapala?
The name escapes me for the moment.
Anyway, once the coalition came, don't you think NM also made a tactical mistake in bringing this body business from their point of view?
Yes, it was a little mistake that that all politicians make.
But now, as you have presented and as many people present today, the danger in the coalition is that the Marxists would take over. But I wonder whether...
The old coalition, and the
opposition coalition of the moment.
Yeah.
I wonder whether Mrs. B is in such a strong position that they can't take it, that she needs the wagon. And
whether they can't take over.
That they are failing her court and in fact forced to give up some of their marks.
You know, I think Mrs. B is a very convenient leader and a label for any opposition group. She certainly has still a very large following in the country, whatever the reason for it. And the leftists are quite aware, certainly in their time, in their lifespan, they have no chance of coming in on their own street. Not this set of leftists, unless the future generation, maybe 25 years hence, there is that possibility.
But don't you think that because of that, because of the inherent nature of the situation, it's Mrs. B who commands, and therefore there is a little danger of the leftists being able to take over?
But I am not so sure of that, you see, because Mrs. B's way of thinking, particularly during that period when she was in the coalition with the people, and the last few days of her, before she handed over her resignation, are indicative of the fact that she wants to stay. Even at a price.
What did you do in the last 2 days? I was not
because here. When the government was defeated, originally, I'm going back down to the press bill, Yeah, she took about a fortnight to announce the government's resignation.
Yes.
Then the government was defeated at the polls. She took a few days after that to hand in her resignation. And I think it was Felix Diaz's insistence that helped to solve the and solve the easy situation. Because the leftists, including Colvin and Peter and NM and the others, were at secretaries, according to reports, trying to persuade her that they would get federal party support and that there was no need for her to tender her resignation.
And wasn't some pressure to brought to bear on Gopal Lava too?
May have been indirectly, but I know that Dudley did go in to see him in the early hours of the morning. I think Sugandhadasa was responsible for taking a letter or something. I don't know whether Dudley saw him or Dudley sent a letter to him. I forget which it was. Sort of warning him about the situation and that he must act.
Isn't that highly unconstitutional?
No, well, the lead to the opposition or a prime minister designate or something like that is entitled to do that. Of course, it would have been far better if the Governor General, following normal precedent, had sent for various people and talked to them about the situation. Including Chelvanayak. She might have done. I think what happened was Sugandhadasa delivered a letter from Chelvanayakam that he was not joining this Bandhanayaka administration and that he would support that.
Oh, I thought this federal party considered it for a while and that Chelvanayakam's son, for instance, was for joining this election.
May have been, but then they had a very long meeting at Tiruchelvan's house one evening. It ran into the early hours of the morning, I think. It was there that they decided to support this government.
Were you present?
No, I wasn't.
Is it true that Mrs. B also took time off to consult astrologers?
Yeah, that she used to do very frequently.
And doesn't Philip himself, for all his Marxism, also have dealings with astrologers?
I don't know that. Most Iranians do, respecting their religion and their political convictions.
There's a theory put forward by the leftist in particular, which I would like you to comment on, namely that the Catholic action, as represented sometimes in the Times, and the Tamil groups have a great influence on the UNP, and that the UNP are merely their pawns.
I don't know, the Catholic action is a very convenient banner to throw in order to divert people's attention from leftist strategy and communism and that kind of thing. As for the Tamils having any kind of the pull on this government, I don't believe there is. We missed the bus in 1956. If Bandhanayaka had, Bandhanayaka's offer to Chelvanayaka had been accepted of portfolios, then we would have been in the government and seen to it that no injustice was done to the Tamils. You see, Chelvanayaka chose to stay out in order to create the public image that he and his party were not interested in office. That is suicidal, to hand over your destiny to an administration and a government, which is consists of fanatics. And again this time, Chelvanayakam was made the same offer by Dudley of three portfolios. He selected one and gave it to the Telugu Muslim Senate because he could not restrain his men in the lower house who were clamoring for office.
Oh, all wanted the two seats?
All wanted. So none got it.
So this is a different reason in 65 to...
Yes, that is a different reason. This is quite different.
Public image among the Tamils?
Well, yes. The Tamils are even the island. Of course, it suited Chelvanayakam well because he was the obvious man who should have been a minister. You know, practice which is worth much more.
And how would you assess Mrs. B as a Prime Minister?
I would say that if Bandhanayaka had Mrs. B's guts, or if she had his intellect, either of them would have been a first-class Prime Minister, without fear in the country. But Bandhanayaka's trouble was his very weak need, and Mrs. B, I think, was far stronger. She certainly knew what she wanted and what was right and wrong. But then he had the number of the... So by the all, even the best of them, all these men, from the Yatra Nagara, all of them have been to flattering. And that is the vine that goes to the head.
And don't you think that she takes advice from numerous quarters and therefore no one knows quite where they stand?
I would say that. I think people like Padma Deen Bhavad have considerable influence over her, completely out of proportion to the public influence that they had.
Yes, how able was Padudi?
Padudi must have been, I suppose, fairly able in comparison to some of the people there. I think he was an educated man. But it was, I think, for the last 10 years, the Ministry of Education that did the most bungling for all governments. Including this.
How about Irandaratna's performance?
I would say he's a man, I may disagree with him in his politics, I have disagreed violently, but I admire him for his convictions and his courage.
Don't you think that one of our key ministries has suffered from the fact that CP has been abused?
It's irrigation
plan. Yes.
Well, I suppose there is not much to show the public for stewardship of 2 years. This time, you're talking about these 2 years.
Yes. Right?
But, you know, that is not a ministry that can show phenomenal results without a loss of money to undertake big projects. See, power and irrigation are things which you can't provide in a day or a year. It may take 5 or 10 years to provide.
Jumping back, how would you assess the UNP period of rule 48-56?
Administratively, first class. You couldn't say that they governed well because, after all, that's a comparative statement, and they had a lot of luck with this boom, Korean boom, helping. But there were certain things that they might have done in retrospect, things like Kalpa Paddy was an unnecessary shock to the farmers, prompted, surprisingly, by Sir Oliver, who was a man who could see far ahead. Free education again was one of the things which Sir Oliver
supported.
What else was there? There were those financial things and the vast amount of money they spent on the university. You know, and public buildings generally at that time.
Was that due to Sir John's influence?
No, it is purely that they wanted to have, they had the money and they felt that they could have the board, the showpiece in anything.
Don't you think they did too much sort of jitterbugging around and their supporters went about in flashy cars and just...
Yeah, but you see, this question of flashy cars is if the country can afford new cars, even in Mrs. Bandaranaike's time, all her supporters would have gone in Mercedes-Benz. You see, it's purely the thing that everybody likes to prove one's position. The fellow who goes in a bicycle wants to get on a motorbike. See, and so on and so forth.
But don't you think that they had no economic program to speak of? And
because they didn't feel the urge and the need for a program from the country's point of view. I'll come there, but what time are you going to be there? I'll be there by 4:30. You see, right?
And what about Sir John's foreign program? Do you think that was missing? The emphasis on foreign glory, shall I say?
No, there was no foreign glory as such. In fact, I don't think anybody from Ceylon would ever have foreign glory. What he was trying to do was to cash in on these various developments abroad and see whether he could be a mediator here or there. But he had one very good concept, this Asian get-together business. You know, the Bandung concept of Afro-Asian entity for mutual consultation and cooperation. It is rather a big plan. But certainly the Big Five of Asia was a good idea. It had not been really developed.
But isn't that a misplaced emphasis? Aren't the internal problems more important?
Yeah, but then the external problems, certainly of immediate neighbors, influences internal policy a lot.
And can you tell me anything about the premier state?
What sort of?
I mean, how correct is it to say that he had in fact told Solbury and wrote called that.
You know, that is a thing that nobody but Solbury could say. But as a result of very close contact with a number of people, the way I put it is that there was a very eminent cardiologist or somebody in that line who had come to Ceylon towards the tail end of DS's life, and he had seen DS, you know, as a consultant, and apparently he had felt that DS's heart was not going to stand the strain, the pace of life, for more than 6 months. This he had indicated to Dr. H.O. Gunawardena, who is not alive now. And Gunawardena had in turn mentioned this to L.M. D. Silva, who was then head of Chamber of Lake House. L.M. had mentioned this to Solbury. So Solbury at his weakest,